Hal, what do you tell people who will say this is impossible to believe 40 years later?
Yeah, I probably would say the same thing. I just know deep in my heart what I heard, and I wanted to make sure that I could set the record straight and that the world know that this was not what it seemed to be.
The Battle of the Sexes was one of the most iconic moments in sports. When tennis star Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs on national television, it was a victory for women everywhere. But what if the match wasn't what it seemed? Today, ESPN investigative reporter Don Van Natta Jr. tells the story of how a single tip led him down a path involving a golf pro, the mob, and an Olive Garden parking lot. And he answers the question, was the whole thing a racket? I'm Mina Kimes. It's Thursday, March 26th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by ADT. Today, with live sports pretty much at a standstill, we're starting a new series of stories I'm calling ESPN Daily Essentials. Basically, every now and then, I will be inviting reporters to come on our show and tell the best ESPN stories of all time, including today's piece, The Matchmaker. Don, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mina. How are you?
I'm better now that we get to talk about one of my favorite stories ESPN has ever published, a piece you wrote a few years ago about the Battle of the Sexes, which is, of course, the infamous tennis match where Billie Jean King, a women's champion, played Bobby Riggs, the former men's champion. Now, people know this story, but not everyone knows the story behind it and how there was actually a crazy mystery involved that you set about to solve. But before we get to that, can you remind people what the Battle of the Sexes was?
The Battle of the Sexes was a tennis exhibition in September of 1973 that came at a perfect moment in American history.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Americans were fatigued and tired of Watergate and Vietnam. And this event was set up by promoters where Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs were going to play to determine a very simple question. Can a woman beat a man on a tennis court?
What a scene it is, almost reminiscent of college football with the celebrities present, with the big band here, with dancing cheerleaders and all of the rest.
50 million people watched on primetime television on September 20th, 1973, and a record that stands to this day, 30,472 people were in attendance at the Houston Astrodome to watch it all.
So this was not Bobby Riggs' first match with a woman, right?
That's right. He had played Margaret Court, who was ranked the number one woman tennis player at the time, 4 months earlier in California, in a exhibition that was on national television on CBS. It actually was played on Mother's Day before 30 million people, and Bobby Riggs won easily over Margaret Court, 6-2, 6-1, and it became known as the Mother's Day Massacre.
So in 1973, where were Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King in their respective careers?
Billie Jean was ranked number two among women tennis players at the time. She was a terrific tennis player, was known for being a leader of the women's liberation movement. She was fighting for equal pay for women players. Bobby Riggs was 55. His time had long come and gone. He was hanging out in California, spending a lot of his time betting on tennis matches and sports and horse racing. But the Battle of the Sexes was hatched by Bobby Riggs. And why he did that was what I set out to try to find out in this story.
He not only hatched it, he promoted the heck out of it, right?
He did. He promoted it around the clock. He did television interviews, television commercials. He did a infamous press conference with Billie Jean King in New York, where he said all sorts of wild male chauvinist claims.
There's a lot of men through the ages that you can admire. I haven't been able to find too many women.
He said that women have no right being out in the world.
Personally, I wish the women would stay in the home and do the kitchen work and take care of the babies.
He said, you know, King Henry VIII knew how to treat his women.
Henry VIII, I loved him because this guy really knew how to handle his women.
Said that on national television.
Girls play a nice game of tennis for girls, but when they get out there on a court with a man, even a tired old man of 55, they're going to be in big trouble.
He played the role of a male chauvinist pig to perfection. And the way he did it really captured the imagination of Americans to see whether a woman could shut up this chauvinistic clown. So Bobby Riggs really turned this into a fascination with Americans in a way that I think exceeded even his expectations.
That's what it's all about, and it is going to be the battle of the sexes. Don't anybody let you tell you it's any different.
So, Don, I was not alive at the time. And not to rub it in, but you were. What were your memories of the Battle of the Sexes?
I was 9 years old. I was in fourth grade living in northern New Jersey. I heard my mom and dad talk a lot about it in the run-up to it in September of 1973. So the three of us sat down and watched the match on ABC, called by Howard Cosell, the great Howard Cosell.
Live from the Astrodome in Houston, Texas, the tennis battle of the sexes, Billie Jean King versus Bobby Riggs.
And we were fascinated with whether or not a woman could beat a man on a tennis court. And I think everybody in our family was rooting for Billie Jean King to win. And we were thrilled with the result.
The winner of the battle of the sexes, Billie Jean King, by scores of 6-4, 6-3, 6-3. She played her own game for a stunning performance against Bobby Riggs. This ABC Sports exclusive has been brought to you by...
So this is, like I said, one of the most sacred sports stories. It's this incredible moment with cultural impact that goes far beyond the court. Then, decades later, Don, you had a story about this match land in your lap that completely overthrows everything most of us know about the Battle of the Sexes. What did you find out?
Well, like any good story, Mina, this one started with a tip. At the end of 2012, I got a tip from a friend of a retired golf instructor, an assistant golf pro who lived in Tampa. A man by the name of Hal Shaw wanted to tell me a story, and it was about the Battle of the Sexes. That piqued my interest, and I thought maybe it's worth a drive up from my house in Miami to Tampa to listen to what Hal has to say.
So you get this hot tip from a retired golf instructor, which, by the way, is the most Florida thing ever.
That's exactly.
What does he tell you?
He told me a story that really seems so preposterous on its face. It's hard to actually retell it with a straight face, Mina, and without laughing.
My name is Hal Shaw. I'm 79 years old. I'm about to tell you a story that's been a secret that I've kept for 40 years.
He claimed that 40 years earlier, in late 1972 or the first week of 1973, he was at the Palmasia Golf Club, where he was an assistant golf pro. That's a golf club in Tampa. He was working late in the bag room after midnight repairing clubs for a tournament the next day. He heard several men come into the pro shop, unlock the door, and sit down.
I heard these voices out front, and I thought someone was trying to break in. So I automatically turned off my bench light and secured the door, and I just remained just dead still.
And he looked through a diamond-shaped window and saw some of the most notorious mobsters of the 20th century congregating in the Palmasia Pro Shop. Frank Regano, a mob lawyer who is a member at Palmasia, was the first man to enter the room. Santo Trafficante Jr., the leader of the Florida mob, followed him. And Carlos Marcello, the leader of the New Orleans mob, followed him. And there was a fourth man who Shaw said he doesn't recognize.
I was petrified, knowing that at any moment, if I did something, that my life could be in jeopardy standing behind that door.
Can you hear them clearly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm probably 20 feet away.
And what do you hear them say?
The main thing that astonished me was they brought up the name of Bobby Riggs.
He eavesdrops through the door and hears them discuss a pitch that was brought to them by Bobby Riggs to set up two exhibition tennis matches in 1973.
Bobby had approached the Regatta about a proposal to set up two matches between the two best women players in the world. He mentioned Margaret Court, and it's easy for me to remember that because one of my aunt's name is Margaret, and the second lady was Billie Jean King. And Riggs had assured him that he would beat Margaret Court, and then he would go in the tank, and he'll make it look and appear that he's trying his best, but Billie Jean King is just overwhelming him.
They made it clear in their conversation that Riggs owed them more than $100,000 in gambling debts.
What does Riggs want out of this? And Regatta says he has asked for his debt to be erased. He's also asked for a certain amount of money, which is to be discussed later, to be put in a bank account for him in England. And Regatta says it's going to be, you know, peanuts compared to what we're going to make out of this.
We should make it clear that Trafficante and Marcello lead two of the nationwide illegal bookmaking wires that accept all the illegal sports wagering bets. And so this was a fix that they were very interested in. And Shaw says he heard at the end of their conversation that they were going to go forward with Bobby Riggs's pitch.
What was your reaction to hearing this from Hal?
You know, I initially thought it was pretty preposterous sounding. This is an elderly guy telling me this story that one of the most iconic events in sports history was not on the level. So I spent 2 days in Tampa. I had a couple of meals with Hal. I sort of did what any detective would do. I had him tell me the story over and over again to see if there were some fissures in what he had to say, if there were some cracks in the narrative. And I knew Hal Shaw from a biography that I had written about Babe Diedrichsen earlier. It was published in 2011. I knew he had a very sharp memory. All the details stayed the same. There was no contradiction. There was no sort of moment where I felt that Hal Shaw had made this up out of whole cloth. And so by the end of the 2 days, when I left Tampa and drove back to Miami, I was pretty sure that Hal Shaw heard what he said he heard. But that's just the beginning of any reporter's quest to get to the truth.
So, Don, you get this wild story. You've done your best to confirm it. What did you do next?
Well, one of the first things I did was I rewatched the match, which was literally like digging into a time capsule from 1973. It was the ABC broadcast, including the commercials. So these old timey, you know, Lincoln Continental ads in part of the tape of what I watched. And one of the things that really stood out is just how poorly Bobby Riggs played.
One hasn't seen in evidence the famed Bobby Riggs lob that much tonight, Gene.
Well, he's been rushed an awful lot, Howard.
This is a player who just 4 months earlier had beaten Margaret Court easily, 6-2, 6-1. Margaret Court was the number one ranked player in the world. But against Billie Jean King, he had all sorts of problems.
Oh, Bobby shakes his head. You rarely will see that from Bobby Riggs.
He couldn't reach the net on some of his shots. This is a guy who had an incredible service game. Bobby Riggs, nearly 50% of his first serves did not go in.
Oh, that first service has been a disaster for him all night.
It didn't look like he was even trying on some of the points. Howard Cosell and the other commentators, they were flabbergasted at how poorly Bobby Riggs was playing.
I don't think he's nonchalanting anything, Gene. I think he's dog tired.
Comes down to the
same
thing.
You're right,
Howard. Bobby lacks the concluder. He's not able to put the ball away and doesn't have the strength to hang in front.
He was a heavy favorite to easily defeat Billie Jean King, and he just played horribly and was off his game from the beginning and to the end. In fact, the final shot, he just hits it into the net, and then Bobby Riggs jumps over the net to congratulate Billie Jean King.
It is over. Let's watch Bobby Riggs.
Bobby. He'll behave like a perfect gentleman.
I knew for me personally, I had to win this match. This was not only for girls and women, this was for people to change. This was about social change. Tennis happened to be the medium of expression.
After the break, let's talk about Bobby Riggs and why the backstory behind the match was somehow even more complicated than it seems. Don, Bobby Riggs passed away in 1995. You published a story in 2013, so you never had the chance to talk to him about it, but you did some reporting on him and learned a lot about his life, and you found a much more complicated character than the sort of stereotypical chauvinist people saw on TV. What did you learn about Bobby Riggs?
Well, I looked back at his backstory. I found out a few interesting things. First of all, I found out what a dominant tennis player he was in his prime. Bobby Riggs was the first player to win basically the Triple Crown at Wimbledon in 1939. He won the men's singles title, the men's doubles title, and the men's mixed doubles title.
Riggs displays his usual tight defense, and today his flashing offense proves unbeatable.
Nobody had ever done that before, and he actually strolled into a London betting shop and saw odds of 25-1 against him doing that and bet on himself and won the equivalent of $1.7 million and then blew it all gambling. And that was the signal to me that Bobby Riggs had a big problem, and that was he wanted to bet on everything that moved. Not just on himself, but on things he couldn't control. He was betting on baccarat in Vegas casinos. He was betting on horse racing. He would bet on every sporting event that he could.
All of the running, all of the chasing, all of the betting, all of the playing. What's it all about?
Well,
do you do it for money, Bobby?
No, I do it for fun. The sport is the thing to do.
Well, how do you
when I can't play for big money, I play for little money. And if I can't play for little money, I stay in bed that day.
He had an ability to, as his friends say, keep his game in the barn. And that was a phrase that basically meant Bobby would play tennis against somebody, purposely lose the first set, maybe even the first two sets, and then bet on himself to come back and win at fatter odds, and almost always managed to do it. And of course, then there were suspicions that he had done that in the way that he set up the Battle of the Sexes.
So this portrait of a guy who's been gambling, betting on himself and other things his entire career would seem to square, right, with the notion that he threw the match. However, the other thing you pointed out, which is that Bobby Riggs was an extremely good player and a hard worker, is in conflict with how he acted before the Battle of the Sexes, right?
Yes. So what was really striking about the reporting that I did is in the run-up to the Margaret Court match, Bobby Riggs was training nonstop, 8 to 10 hours a day. He was running. He was playing against really good tennis players to get himself in playing shape for Margaret Court and for beating her so handily 6-2, 6-1 on Mother's Day. After that match, he stopped training. He stopped exercising. All he did was party in the Los Angeles area. No training at all.
Bobby's practice sessions are really more like money orgies. He took $100 from a shoe manufacturer in this match against one player and 32 chairs.
He was drinking constantly, and this really concerned his son, Larry Riggs, who I interviewed for this story. He didn't understand why Bobby wasn't preparing for this huge nationally televised match. And that's when Larry Riggs started getting very curious and wondering what was really going on here.
So that's what Bobby's son told you, Don. What did his best friend say?
Well, Bobby Riggs' best friend is a guy named Lorne Kuehl, who I also interviewed. Lorne Kuehl and Larry Riggs agreed to be interviewed on camera for this story. I flew out to St. Louis to meet with those guys in Southern Illinois during the reporting of it. And as I was driving up to meet them, Lorne Kuehl called me, and he almost called the interview off. He was really furious that I had called a bunch of Bobby Riggs's old gambling buddies in Vegas, and it got back to him. And so we had kind of a peace offering dinner at the Olive Garden. And during that dinner, I was stunned when Larry Riggs told me for the first time that these mobsters kept visiting his dad in the weeks leading up to the match.
Did he know mafia guys? Absolutely. Is it possible these guys were talking some shit? Yes. Is it possible that they talked to him about doing it? Possible.
And they were connected to the Chicago hitman named Jackie the Lackey Cerrone. The reason why I almost fell off my chair during the Olive Garden dinner, Mina, is because that is precisely what Hal Shaw had told me. Somebody from Chicago would engineer the fix. Now, Larry Riggs didn't know what Hal Shaw had told me. I simply was sitting having dinner trying to make sure these guys were going to sit with me for a TV interview the next day. And Lorne became furious at Larry Riggs when Larry said that.
I've never heard anything so ridiculous, so far-fetched, and it's just complete bullshit. There's no mob people involved with this match. I mean, the mob doesn't even play tennis.
And after the dinner, I'll never forget Lorne Kuehl, who's about 6'4", towering over Larry Riggs, who's short like his father, in the Olive Garden parking lot. Lorne had his finger pushing into Larry's chest, yelling at him. Clearly, Larry Riggs' allegation that there were these mob guys circulating around this match infuriated Bobby Riggs' best friend. And quite frankly, it wasn't until that Olive Garden dinner, Mina, that I felt, okay, I've got a story here.
So, Don, when you walked away from this dinner, having just broken breadsticks with Larry Riggs' son and his best friend, what did you think? Did you come away thinking that one or both of them thought that Bobby had rigged it?
I certainly had the feeling that Larry Riggs had a suspicion that something was going on beyond his father's performance and the lack of preparation. But it was clear to me that Lorne Kuehl certainly believed that the match was on the level. And this allegation, I don't think it was the first time he'd heard Larry Riggs say it, really infuriated him.
What was it like for Larry to watch his father play Billie Jean King?
Larry Riggs didn't even bother traveling to Houston to watch the match in person. He was so upset at his father for failing to prepare for the match. He was sure his dad was going to lose to Billie Jean King. He was so sure, by the way, that he placed a bet on Billie Jean King to win. He stayed in Los Angeles, and he was just really, really frustrated that his father didn't prepare and felt there was something else going on.
So Bobby Riggs' own son bet against him in the Battle of the Sexes and ostensibly won money.
Yes, he won money on Billie Jean King. There was not a lot of money on Billie Jean King. Jimmy the Greek famously said that in the run-up to the match. But Bobby Riggs' own son bet against his father. That's how sure he was that Bobby Riggs was going to lose to Billie Jean King.
What did you find out about how Bobby reacted after the match?
Bobby, right after the match, was convinced that Billie Jean King was going to give him a rematch and basically called for one and was very disappointed to find out in the days after that he was not going to get that rematch. He was staying at the Astroland Hotel in Houston, and he told his son on the phone.
He took an ice bath after the match in his room, and he said he was contemplating drowning himself, that it was the worst thing in the world he has ever done. This is the worst thing I've ever done.
This was the worst thing I've ever done in my life. So my goal as a journalist was to try to figure out exactly what that meant. Was it because he had gone forward with a fix that he then regretted? Was it because he lost on purpose, setting aside the mob allegations, and just lost on purpose because he wanted a rematch that would be a much bigger payday? Or maybe both of those things were going on at the same time.
You also spoke with Billie Jean King herself. After you had done all this reporting, what did she have to say?
Well, you know, she was very surprised by the allegations that Hal Shaw made. I interviewed her on camera in New York City just a week before our story was published in 2013. And she said to me repeatedly on camera, Bobby Riggs did not throw this match. I know it. And when I said to her about the mobsters and what Hal Shaw had heard, she insisted to me that Bobby did not hang around with mobsters.
I would bet my life that Bobby never had that discussion with him. Now, maybe they had that discussion with themselves,
you know, because they're mobsters. But Bobby, that's not Bobby.
Well, one of the things that we
Bobby
learned
doesn't get involved with mobsters. That's not Bobby. Keeps it.
Actually, Billy, he did. I had to say to her, "Actually, Billy, he did," and her jaw literally dropped on camera. She had no idea that Bobby Riggs had spent so many years in the 50s, 60s, and even early 70s playing cards with mobsters, playing golf with them. He was hardwired into that world, and Billie Jean King had no idea until I told her in 2013.
I'm going to tell you, I know when a player wants to win and when they don't want to win. Bobby Riggs wanted to win that match. I saw it in his eyes. I saw it when we changed ends.
Billie Jean King is absolutely convinced to this day that Bobby Riggs wanted to win, did everything possible to win, and just wasn't in good enough shape to do it, and just had an off match that night.
And there is no question. I have played matches where players have tanked, and I know what it feels like, and I know what it looks like, and he did not.
How well did Billie Jean know Bobby Riggs?
They got to know each other really well after the match and became really close friends. And just a couple of days before Bobby Riggs died, Billie Jean called him. They had a phone conversation and Bobby Riggs said to Billie Jean King, "I love you." Billie Jean told Bobby, "I love you." And Bobby said, "You know, we did something pretty good, didn't we? We really made a difference." And I ended my story with that quote, because it's so telling. Not only did they have a great friendship and great relationship, but Bobby Riggs was only playing a character when he was a male chauvinist pig. In fact, Bobby Riggs's first tennis coach back in LA was a woman. Everyone around Bobby Riggs told me he was very liberal minded. He rooted for the women's liberation movement. So, you know, in this world, mean as you know, we do things for multiple motives. Bobby could have done it also because he felt this was great for the women's liberation movement if I didn't play my best. So he could have thrown the match for multiple motives.
That quote from Bobby to Billie Jean that, you know, we did something great. I think it's a reminder of why this story is so fraught, right? And perhaps why there's so many conflicting opinions and there's so much uncertainty around it still, because it's not just a great sports story. It was an important moment in culture, in the history of women's liberation. If it's true that Bobby Riggs did throw the match, do you think it changes that story?
I don't think it changes it at all. Not one bit. The way women felt watching Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs, this male chauvinist jerk, shut his mouth in the way that she did. She did it in such a dominant manner. Remember, in 1973, women needed a man to co-sign with the bank to get a credit card. This meant so much to women's liberation. It led to all sorts of advancements. The empowering aspect of this and what it meant to women doesn't really change because there's a circumstantial case, I think a pretty strong circumstantial case, that in fact the match wasn't exactly as it appeared on that September night in 1973.
Thanks so much, Don.
Thank you, Mina.
You can find Don's entire feature, The Matchmaker, on ESPN.com. Coming up, the Olympics have been postponed for 1 year, which might be too long for some. Here's another story I want you to know. With the news that the Tokyo Olympic Games have officially been postponed until 2021, athletes from around the world are trying to find a way forward and looking ahead to their next chance to compete. But for some, that opportunity will never come. According to a piece on 538.com by Neil Payne, many Olympic athletes, the majority of them, in fact, only have one shot at medaling. The data gathered by Payne and his team shows that of the athletes who have competed in the Olympics in the past, 74% only made it to a single games. 19% recorded two appearances. 6% participated in three games, and less than 2% competed in four or more. Unsurprisingly, the sport you play matters a great deal. Table tennis, for example, has a lot of repeat competitors. 43% of them come back for more than one games. Meanwhile, on the other side, soccer has the highest percentage of players who appear in only one Olympics at 92%. Now, this will be somewhat alleviated if, as currently planned, the Tokyo Games are only pushed back a single year. But even so, the delay will rule out many athletes. Payne points out that when the Winter Olympics were held in 1992 and 1994 with a two-year gap, less than half of the athletes who competed in 1992 came back. But this isn't bad news for everyone. Some younger competitors will now qualify for the postponed Olympics as their timelines accelerate, including potentially American gymnast Connor McClain, who missed the 2020 eligibility cutoff for the senior national team by 32 days. With the games pushed a year, if the age restrictions move as well, she may be able to try out. But for many athletes who are planning on competing in Tokyo this summer, the postponement is heartbreaking news as their windows shut. Every cost is relative now, of course, given the level of serious tragedy occurring around the world, but it's a cost nonetheless. I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.